Welcome to The Close Read, a podcast where a married couple learns more about each other through the books of their childhood. Every episode, we focus on one book that one of us read during our formative years that the other did not. I'm one of your co-hosts, Jay DeFacto, and I'm sitting here next to...
Lynn Carhide, his wife, that's me.
And today we're going to be talking about the book Henry Reed, Inc. Okay, so Lynn... Give us a little summary of the book. Give us a little plot summary of Henry Reed, Inc.
This book is really cute. So it's one of those stories for kids that doesn't really have a very strong through plot. Instead, it gives you a frame, and you have a bunch of little anecdotes within that frame. And there's a couple of themes that run throughout the book. But the basics are that you are reading the journal, not diary, okay? That's important. The journal of Henry Reed. Henry Reed is like 13 or 14 at the beginning of the book. He's about to enter eighth grade. And one of the cool things about Henry Reed's life is that he is the son of a diplomat. And so currently he's actually living most of the year in Italy. However, for the summer, sometime in the late 1950s, Henry gets sent to spend the summer with his aunt and uncle, his Aunt Mabel, his Uncle Al, in Princeton, New Jersey. They're outside of Princeton, New Jersey, far enough that really the neighborhood is 9 entire houses. And while Henry is there, he has a school assignment where he's supposed to investigate and come back with some sort of insights about free enterprise. So he starts a local business, he makes a local friend, he picks up a local beagle, and there's a bunch of antics along the way.
That's really good. That's a good little summary of the book. Yeah, it is one of those books that doesn't really have a plot, right? It's got a bunch of little adventures that happen, and they get related to us, the readers. And Henry is our narrator throughout the whole thing. It's told in the first person. Oh man, what's the term for a story that's all letters?
Epistolary.
Yes.
I can never say this right. Epistolary.
Epistolary.
Epistolary. There we go.
It's an epistolary novel. It's all excerpts or entries from his journal that he keeps over this summer. Do you want to start us off with a topic of conversation?
I was looking at the information on this book. What reading level would you ballpark this book at? And what age were you at when you read it?
I think I was 8 or 9 years old when I read it the first time. I could have been a little bit older, maybe 10, but I don't think I was more than 10 years old. The reading level is, I would say, certainly about a second or third grade reading level. It's a chapter book. You know, the chapters are his diary entries, his journal entries, and there are paragraphs and paragraphs and pages of text, and there are illustrations in the book, but they are certainly not the focus. It's, you know, got a lot more words than pictures. So I'd say about second or third grade.
Yeah. So it's definitely one of those books that's written with an older protagonist, but at a much younger reading level. I remember reading a lot of those as a kid and kind of forming my idea of what I would be doing later in my life based on, like, you know, what the protagonists of these books were doing when they were 13, 14.
Yeah, I had a lot of the same experience with books like that. You develop this idea of what your later adolescence is going to be like, or at least I did. I developed my idea of what my later adolescence was going to be like based on, in large part, these books. Books where the main character is a little bit older than the reader, and the character's adventures and decisions and actions influence how, at least I thought, you know, this is what my teenage years are going to be like.
This is what it is to be a teenager.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this book in particular was kind of unusual in that respect for me because it takes place during this period of American experience that was already long past accessible by the time I was becoming an adolescent.
Yeah.
The book takes place in the late 1950s, and the things that happen in this book really can't happen today, or at least couldn't happen to a kid growing up in a fairly urbanized environment like I did.
I was thinking about that while I was reading it, how much of this is I mean, a lot of it made sense to me, and I could project my own childhood on it, but in that way where I grew up reading books from this era at this age, there was just enough of a through line and just enough of a sort of learned association or learned translation in my head of, like, you know, what the Narnia kids are experiencing, translating it back to what I was experiencing. So I thought it was interesting that way. There's some things in here that I think could be updated fairly decently. But I'm actually very glad that the edition that we read anyway didn't try to do that. Because I have read some books like this from my childhood where they went back and, like, inserted iPhones and stuff into it. And it's just, it's abysmal. It's horrible.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had never considered that that would happen to a text like this, but I guess I'm glad that it hasn't. That inaccessibility of experience, of the things that happen in this book, I feel like there's something special about the way that it differs from, like, the inaccessibility of things that happen in, for example, fantasy novels.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Because when you're reading a fantasy book, you know, you accept that, well, I'm never going to be riding a dragon. Okay, fine. No big deal. But when you read about other kids having adventures that are, you know, fairly realistic and appeal to this sense of verisimilitude, you, or at least I, certainly experienced this idea of, I don't even know how to say this. I experienced almost a sense of loss when I read books like this, because I knew that I would never be able to, you know, go in the country and start a worm farm like this kid or something, right? Like Henry Reed. I didn't inherit an old barn that belongs to my mom and start a business out of it. That's not something that was possible.
I mean, if you want, we could get you some worms now. There's a lot of old barns around.
Farming sucks.
Well, that's the other thing, right? Also, I'd like to pick a small nit with what you just said. I will one day ride a dragon, so FYI.
Yeah, that was predictable.
I think that's interesting, though, that sense of loss. I don't know that I had a sense of loss in the same way, but there's definitely a sense of difference. And I guess what comes across to me is the most obvious thing, right, is the presence or absence of technology and how that could have changed the story. I think for us, because of our age, it's easy to remember a time when we didn't have a phone on us constantly and the internet wasn't a thing. And so this sort of childhood story where the core of it is really like Henry not knowing things and finding things out or experimenting with things and feeling like somewhat isolated, not having that many people to interact with except for Midge and Agony and his aunt and uncle. Although he doesn't say he feels isolated in the book ever, but there is a strong sense of, like, countryside, peace, isolation.
Well, it's a really internal novel in that
yeah,
way, right?
Like, yeah.
All of the things that happen are entirely Henry-focused, and really, the sphere of things that happen in this book don't extend much beyond his personal experience.
And his personal experience in these experiences is very much like in a little bubble away from his real life. And that's something that he doesn't say explicitly, but kind of references repeatedly, is this idea of this is what he's doing for right now, and then he's going to go back and tell people about it in Italy in school. But anyway, the point of my digression was to say that you and I can remember a time when our lives were a little bit more like this. And I wonder what someone even like, you know, 5-10 years younger than us would make of something like this, if it's already just completely inaccessible.
Yeah, or kids born after 2000.
Yeah.
You know, who have had cell phones since they were 7 years old or whatever.
Right.
Yeah.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Well, you picked this book. It was a charming book. I really liked reading it. But why'd you pick it?
Okay, so I picked this book because I remember vividly reading it several times as a kid. And it's kind of a funny pick for me because, well, for a number of reasons. First of all, it describes this vision of American adolescence that was wholly distinct from anything I ever experienced. I didn't do anything like the adventures that Henry has in this book. Absolutely none of my life looked like this text, even though when I read it, my main feeling was, man, it would be cool if the things that happen in this book happened to me in real life. This is my thought as a 9-year-old reading this book or whatever, right? Like, I want to find a cool dog and he'll be my friend. And then I'll put him in a helium balloon, or a hydrogen balloon, actually, in the book. I'll put him in a hydrogen balloon and he'll have an adventure over town. That's not, like, that didn't happen to me or anybody I ever knew. Right, it's a purely fictional invention, but the book generated in me this feeling of wanting these kinds of adolescent adventures. I also picked this book because I wanted to reflect on the development of my sense of gender and masculinity. And there's a lot of stuff that happens in this book that I didn't think about as a kid. I didn't think about it affecting me and my self-image as, you know, a young boy growing into a young man. But it absolutely did. And on the reread, and when I just reread it recently, I thought a lot about that. This book is just, it's saturated in gender politics.
Very much.
And part of it is the fact that it was written in the late 1950s, and all of the characters are very much caricatures of gender stereotypes. Henry's aunt and uncle, for example, are basically out of a Norman Rockwell painting.
Well, the whole book is a Norman Rockwell painting, but I take your meaning.
Yeah, yeah. And Midge is like the definition of a tomboy.
Yeah.
And Henry is a book smart, but also kind of street smart kid. He likes being out in nature, and he, you know, knows a lot about the natural world, and he is inquisitive and scientific and methodical. And a lot of these things are traits that I valued as a kid, and, you know, to an extent still do.
Yeah, that makes sense. I noticed that about the characters all being kind of caricatures. My read on it, though, was more, yeah, definitely this is very heavily influenced and constructed by the gender politics of the 1950s. But it's also pretty progressive by the standards of the late 1950s, right? Just having a tomboy character who doesn't get essentially like put in her place by the end of the book is kind of a big deal. And the way that Henry's aunt and uncle talk to each other is much more as equals than one would kind of expect from a book set in this time.
Yeah, it's very idyllic in that sense.
Yeah.
You know, maybe the most famous piece of media that depicts the time period right after this is Mad Men. Lord. And the gender politics therein are far from idyllic, right? Whereas this book, yeah, I mean, like, Aunt Mabel and Uncle Al have a very clearly loving and supportive relationship.
Al doesn't talk to her like she's a servant, yeah, which is a big deal.
Yeah, they're essentially equal partners in this relationship. And even though Henry and Midge's relationship is kind of transactional, actually it's explicitly transactional.
And Midge likes it that way.
Yeah, yeah. She is very much a great foil for Henry in this book, which I really like, actually.
Maybe we should back up and explain a little bit about the characters. So we mentioned Aunt Mabel and Uncle Al. We mentioned Henry. We didn't really talk about who Midge is. Midge is a local girl who everybody, like, because there's only 9 houses in this dang suburb, not even town. They all kind of know each other and are maybe like a little related to each other or something. Midge is the kid of somebody who Henry's parents knew when they lived in the town, because they, or his mom at least, grew up here. So it's some sort of relationship, kind of. But it's one of those relationships where, like, your parents will tell you, oh, you should talk to whoever, this person exists, and you're like, they have nothing to do with me, why would I ever talk to them? So these two meet entirely on accident, and they form this business together. Or rather, Midge decides that she should be part of the business once she sees Henry painting this sign for his business. And they have a very funny relationship where the kind of first thing that Henry has to say about Midge is that she's 2 years younger than him, and therefore he's much more mature. Which, I thought was very funny. And, you know, it's kind of technically true at that age. Like, a year or two makes a big difference developmentally, but
well, and then
not
she
as
has,
much as he thinks.
Well, and then she's got this immediate riposte to him.
Yeah.
Where she's like, yeah, but on the other hand, you look at all his newspaper articles talking about the teens doing vandalism. That's you, buddy. I'm not a teen yet. That's not me.
I really like that. It was so good. She's really quick, and she's very, I don't even know how to describe her. I really enjoyed her character, and I really enjoyed that Henry is annoyed by her constantly, but isn't annoyed in a way that is, like, stereotypical and shitty.
Yeah, yeah.
He's annoyed by the fact that she's kind of an annoying person.
Yeah, well, you know, she's she's a 12-year-old tomboy who loves getting into scrapes and scraps, and
she loves the bottom line.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, she's all about the Benjamins.
She's the best example of free enterprise in this book.
And okay, so yeah, the other character we have to mention is Agony.
Oh, Agony.
Agony is a beagle, a wonderful beagle that Henry and his aunt and uncle find in the road on the drive home on Henry's very first night in Princeton.
That was the first part of the book that I bookmarked, actually, was Uncle Al trying to avoid bringing Agony home, because he knew the instant they saw a dog in the road, he was like, ah, God, okay.
That's great. Yeah.
So he tries to make a case for leaving the dog. He tries to avoid pulling over. When they pick up the dog, he keeps saying, you know, Agony has a collar, he must belong to somebody. But of course, Agony sticks around. It gets the name Agony because...
He gets the name Agony because he has a howl that he unleashes when he doesn't get what he wants, such as sleeping at Henry's bedside. Those of you who have ever had beagles or are familiar with their howls will know that from a small animal can come a tremendous noise. And Agony is extremely well named because of that.
It's just such a good name for a beagle, but also for an animal in general. I really wish we'd named one of our cats Agony. It's so good. All right, so you got Henry and Midge. Henry starts this business, Henry Reed Inc., and it's, I think, the funniest business I have read about in a children's novel, because a huge part of the book, like almost a character itself, is the presence of Princeton University, right? You've got, not just that, but you've got like a bunch of people associated with like various military things going on. So you have a real hotspot of intellectuals and research happening. And so Henry very logically decides, okay, I'm supposed to learn about free enterprise. I'm seeing research stuff everywhere. Everybody has a PhD. I'm going to just start up my own research outfit. Makes perfect sense.
Yeah, yeah. This is one of those aspects of the setting that is not accessible to a modern audience if you're a kid, right? If you're a kid and you live in a university town, hell, if you're an undergrad and you live in a university town, you're not doing research.
Which is a kind of kid. Yeah.
Yeah. Research is one of those things. And, you know, obviously the research that Henry does is not, like, real research, academic research.
He really only does research in, like, maybe two projects. One on accident and one where he does his prototype at the end of the book.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's... So Princeton in the late 1950s, during a time period of American... the expansion of the United States collegiate system...
Mm-hmm.
The tremendous expansion of the United States collegiate system and the push for American intellectual superiority.
Right.
Right.
It's one of your fronts of the Cold War.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The development of the intelligence community. Yeah, there's a lot of little things like that that are sort of under the setting of the book, but that do inform a lot of the things that happen in it.
Yeah. And there's a lot of really funny little comments here. It's definitely one of those books that's written in a way where it'll be accessible and fun to kids, but there's also a lot for adults to laugh at. And it's very explicitly written into the book because Aunt Mabel and Uncle Al will be laughing about stuff or making jokes that completely fly over Henry's head, and he'll record him the jokes in his journal and say, I don't get what they were talking about. This is very silly to me.
I really like that aspect of the book.
It's really cute. There's one, there's a couple of those that I bookmarked, especially along the topic of research, and one of them is when they're talking about the value of public opinion research, and Henry says, well, when they go out and ask these questions, do they ask experts? I asked. No, just the man on the street, Uncle Al answered. But he might not know what he was talking about. He probably doesn't. Well, I don't see the sense in that, I objected. Why go ask a lot of people who don't know much about a subject, or who don't know more about a subject than anyone else? Who cares what their opinion is? Isn't your own just as good? You know, I never thought of it that way before, Uncle Al said, but you've got a point. It's really, it's just, it's really good. As a kid, I would have read that and been like, yeah, Henry is very sensible. I will never pay attention to public opinion polls. And then I got super into politics, and RIP me. It's one of those books where you have a wealth of very absurd things happening that are, you know, they kind of try the patience of an adult reader, but for a kid, it really keeps the book kind of clipping along.
Yeah.
Each one of these anecdotes is very funny, a series of unfortunate events, but that are, you know, nobody gets hurt and their plate is very funny. So in one of them, Henry and Midge end up driving like a little lawnmower tractor thing,
mm-hmm.
With a wagon on the back of it and then another thing attached to the back of that. And they're trying to pull, what is it that they're pulling? They've got the hay in the wagon and then
the bathtub.
The bathtub. They're driving along a country lane with a bunch of stuff being towed behind a little tractor. And of course, predictably, everything kind of breaks down and they block the whole road and it's blocked for miles on either end. And there's a newspaper reporter who ends up showing up and kind of recording what's happening. And he makes a number of jokes about how it took like 3 PhDs and 2 nuclear engineers and like a professor of German literature to undo the roadblock. It's very funny. I enjoyed it.
That's one of those comedic elements that I sort of recognized the shape of as a kid when I read it.
Like
I
could tell, like, of a joke.
Exactly. You know, purred happily. It has the cadence of a joke. But I didn't really get why it was funny until I read it later as an adult. And it's hilarious.
It's really good. I like that part.
It's incredibly funny.
The adults are constantly simultaneously making fun of Henry and also, like, not making fun of him.
They're very supportive of him.
Yeah,
it's great.
They're very genuine.
It's very wholesome in a lot of ways, actually.
Yeah.
So here's something that I wanted to mention. I've stated that I wanted the things that happened in this book to happen to me as a kid. But I never actually identified with the character of Henry Reed.
I was curious about that. There's a couple things he says, like that thing about the opinion polls, and then there's a part later in the book where he basically says, plan ahead, you turkeys. And that's very you. But I didn't see a lot of you in this character at all, or any of the characters really, except maybe Agony.
Yeah, I'll cop to that. I didn't identify with Henry as a character. I identified with the adventures and the things that were happening, but I didn't read this book the way I read a lot of children's books when I was a kid, or the way a lot of children read books in general, which is identifying strongly with the main characters.
Mm-hmm.
There are no characters in this book that I was like, yeah, that's me. That's me in literature. That's me in fiction. This is part of a trend that I've noticed in my own reading over the course of my lifetime, which is that I don't frequently identify strongly with characters in books. That's not always true, but it frequently is. I noticed later on when I would read books that I read them for their writing, for their plots, for their imaginations. But I often didn't read books because the character in particular appealed to me. The characters in particular appealed to me. I even realized when I was rereading this book, I had no memory whatsoever of the illustrations.
Mm.
And the illustrations are not forgettable. Like, they're great little illustrations of the things that happen in the book.
Yeah, they have a lot of character. It's a nice style.
It's wonderful, but I didn't commit them to memory the way that I remembered things like Henry's adventure with the hydrogen balloon, or the unveiling of the mystery of Mr. Apple's yard. These are the things that I remembered most about the book, because that's the stuff that I cared about. I cared about the plotting and the adventures, but I didn't care strongly about seeing myself in the characters in the text or in the pictures.
Do you think that's like a gender, race, class thing as much as it is what you like about books?
That's entirely possible here, yeah.
Yeah, because there's not a lot of, like, there's not that many books about a Latino kid growing up in a big city, right? And I feel like that's an area of literature that's been expanded hugely in the last, like, 10, 15 years.
Yeah.
But there just wasn't a lot that wasn't about kids like Henry Reed when we were growing up.
Well, and they certainly couldn't be found in my school library,
right,
which is where I'm sure I picked up this book when I was a kid.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Now, that said, there are books that I can think of where I identified strongly with the main character.
Yeah.
And we are going to read some of those books in this podcast.
You identified strongly with the main character in Sphere. Sphere.
Yes, the Sphere. Yeah, but this book was one of many where I read it and enjoyed it because I really liked the adventures and the things that were happening, and not because I myself felt a deep connection to the characters.
Yeah, there's nothing in here. At the same time that I said that there's parts of it that feel accessible to me, even having grown up outside of a small town, a lot of the descriptions of the country and stuff, they're just, this doesn't make a ton of sense to me either. There's not a lot for me to identify with. Not being a rabid capitalist like Midge, it's, you know, hard.
Well, I was going to ask, on the other hand, do you feel that if you had read this as a kid, you would have identified at all with either Henry or Midge?
You know, I was thinking about that as I read this. I was thinking, I guess, more broadly about whether I would have ever picked up this book at all. Now, the number one problem with it is I'm looking at the cover and there's not a single dragon. So that's a problem. I did read some stuff that didn't have dragons on the cover, but it had to have like a cool ghost or something. You know, like you got to have something for me here. Not just like a kid at a desk. Although I do actually really like the cover illustration on this edition. It's like a nice little, here's everything that's going to happen in this book. This is really different from the books that I would have picked up at all. It's not the genre that I would pick up. And the other thing that I think would have been maybe a little bit difficult for me is I think I would have struggled with the fact that there isn't like one plot going on. What it reminded me most strongly of was a series of books by a Canadian author, Gordon Corman, that I really liked. He wrote a bunch of books about these two kids, Bruno and Boots, who are best friends and go to a boarding school in Canada. And they're roughly the same age. It's like middle school, high school kind of thing. And each one of the books about those two characters has an overarching plot. And they have like really zany little adventures that are really similar to the stuff that happens in here. But each one of those adventures is related to an attempt to do something with the main plot. So there's one book where, if I remember correctly, they think that the school is going to have to shut down because of budget reasons. And so every one of the chapters has some sort of zany attempt at raising money for the school, right?
So there's a little more teleology in that,
yeah,
that
there's,
series.
There's a little bit more structure.
Yeah.
There's something that the book is driving toward.
That's kind of one thing about Henry Reed Inc. is that a lot of the little adventures that happen could almost happen in any number of orders.
Yeah.
Any number of sequences.
It's not like a strong causality happening here.
No. There are a few things that have to happen in order.
Right. Mr. Apple's garden, all the little like, or lawn, all the little bits about that.
Yeah.
That's the closest you get though, I think.
Yeah. For the most part, there is not a strong through narrative.
Yeah. Now, that being said, I really liked the Bruno and Boots books for a couple of reasons. One is because I was sort of fascinated by boarding schools as a kid. Like, I think a lot of kids maybe unconsciously are. Like, I think that's a big part of why Harry Potter is so popular. It's magic boarding school, right? This idea that you're, and I read a bunch of magic boarding school type books. You are making a face like you've never had this experience.
I have never had this experience. I have never felt a strong need or attraction to the boarding school experience, even as a kid.
I think it's something that was really prevalent in the books that I read that were either English or inspired by English
literature. I was going to say, yeah, the whites are at it again.
Yep, we are. So I think there's some of that. I also think there's something kind of interesting as a kid about, like, the idea of a boarding school is the society entirely of children. It's like Lord of the Flies, but like with one level of violence back, if that. Everybody showers more, I guess. Anyway, so I was interested in the boarding school aspect of it, kind of fascinated by this idea. But also, I really liked the two characters of Bruno and Boots. I really liked their dynamic, and I saw parts of myself in both of them. And I think the books were written specifically to do that to kids. There's like a very strong sense of mischievousness, but also a sense of responsibility and loyalty to friends. And, you know, those are really basic building blocks of most children's literature. But I don't actually get either of those from Henry Reed. Henry is honestly a kid who is a little bit insufferable.
Yes.
Yeah. One of the things I like about him is that he has this extraordinary life that he doesn't realize is extraordinary.
Yeah.
He's a child of a diplomat, and he moves to different countries like every couple of years. That's really cool. He doesn't know it's cool, which is great. That's like a really redeeming quality about him. But he is a little bit stuck up. He is a little bit snotty, and he is very certain that he is correct 100% of the time.
Yes.
Yeah. And so those things I don't identify with, even though I am correct 100% of the time.
Well, that's one thing. That's a good connection there. Yeah. That's one thing I've thought about with this book, which is that the character of Henry Reed represents this sort of adolescent American ideal male in a lot of ways as a vision of the 1950s.
Yeah.
Right? Like, yeah. In that time period, you have very real concentrated efforts to cultivate an American culture that saw itself as infallible and as the foundation of the modern world. And this was an explicit project by American cultural and governmental institutions.
Many of whom were located in Princeton, New Jersey at the time, right?
Yeah, yeah. But there was a sense in that time period that America was the country of the future.
Yeah.
Right? And that was very explicitly cultivated by institutions around the country.
And that sort of permeates this book too, I think.
This gets to something that I wanted to talk about, which is the frame story. The frame story of this book is something that pretty much I read and immediately forgot when I was a kid because it only sets up everything. And like we've said, there isn't a strong plot, but reading it as an adult, it feels a lot more insidious. The frame story of this book is that Henry has an assignment from his school that he has to complete over the summer. And that is to produce something, to learn something about free enterprise. Essentially, his assignment is come back and teach the class, share with the class why capitalism is good.
I was curious about this for a couple of reasons. One is that he mentions that he goes to school with a bunch of other diplomats' kids. So it's not just other American staff overseas. Like, it's a bunch of different people. And I don't know shit about the U.S.'s relationship with Italy in this time period. I don't know really anything about Italian politics. So I was curious if there was some sort of ideology happening there that I was completely unaware of, or if it was really the ideology that I think you're driving at, which is this idea of free enterprise and Americanism being kind of tied together. Capitalism is America and America is capitalism.
Right. Yeah. Well, I guess, first of all, I didn't have the same vision of his class as you did.
Oh, okay. I just read that?
Yeah. Well, I guess I just didn't pay close attention to the names of his other classmates, which he does mention at one point. He mentions a few of their names.
Yeah.
But I didn't recall them being particularly Italian. When he has class with other diplomats' kids, I just assumed they were other American diplomats. You know, there would be a number of them.
Yeah, I might have totally misunderstood that.
Yeah.
In that case, it would make more sense, though, for the class to be like, okay, we're all in Italy. However, y'all gotta remember, America number one.
Right. So I was doing a little bit of reading on this topic. It is an accepted truth that different branches of the United States government went out to explicitly evangelize capitalism in the 1940s and 50s. They produced, how do I say this? I guess they didn't produce. They participated in a number of different spheres in public art and in institutions around the world with the express purpose of evangelizing American modern capitalism, modern American capitalism. I guess sort of famously, I should say very explicitly, it's like the CIA funded certain modern artists. And they did this through subsidiary organizations and cultural institutions that they would fund to do things like buy pieces of art from Jackson Pollock and other artists that they felt represented these American ideals.
And more importantly, especially with Pollock, could counter trends coming from the Soviet Union.
Yeah, that was the explicit project here, was like, hey, the way we're doing things is correct, the American capitalist way, and we're going to prove that by showing the superiority of our technology, our education systems, our art production, all of this stuff.
Which worked out really well for us here in 2021. No regrets.
And when I read this book, I thought about how it participates in the capitalist evangelization project that was so popular in this time period.
I thought about that too.
I don't know if I would say that this book was consciously doing that as part of its raison d'etre, but I do think that it was produced during a time period that facilitated pieces of literature that participated in that effort.
Yeah, it's one of those things where it doesn't really matter if it was explicitly funded by the CIA. It fits in with everything else they were funding.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah. I was thinking about that too when I was reading this, and I thought it was very funny that at the same time that it's trying to sort of evangelize American capitalism through Henry's experiences, the whole thing, the like frame of the story is the journal about the business, right? And about his experiences with free enterprise. At the same time that it's trying to evangelize those things, it has a lot of America's structural faults baked right into it. Like, the reason that Henry can start a business at all is that he has property he's inherited from his mom.
Yeah.
Or he can use his mom's property, right? Yeah. You've got your generational wealth creating more wealth baked in right there. Why does Midge not have a business? Because she doesn't have a barn to put it in, right? So it kind of starts off on the wrong foot or the right foot, depending on how you look at it.
Right, yeah. Well, yeah, I think that's exactly apt.
Right. What kind of resources do you already have that you can bring to create more resources for yourself?
Yeah. And so, you know, I described that earlier as insidious. And maybe that's a strong word, but I do think that it's important to recognize that the structures within which even, you know, little kids' adventure books take place can reflect the attitude of the culture that produced them. And this book was produced during a time period where evangelizing the United States as the leader of the future, the country of the future, was the explicit project of lots of cultural production.
Yeah. At the same time that that's true, it's still a charming book. It's not super overwhelming. It's just kind of... Actually, you know what? I wonder if I would find it super overwhelming if I was from a different culture reading it. I wonder if I would the whole time be like, man, come on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, not to say that it isn't charming, of course. It's a very charming book.
Well, that's
You're
part
absolutely
of how it works.
Right about that.
Yeah, yeah, that's why it's effective, is it, you know, does these ideological battles while also being enjoyable to read. Much unlike Jackson Pollock's paintings, booyah!
I don't have strong opinions about Jackson Pollock's paintings, but yeah, sure, why not? Screw you, Pollock. So one funny thing about this book for me when I read it as a kid was that it introduced me to a number of concepts that were, until I read them in this book, completely foreign to me. I grew up in a pretty urbanized city, you know, a couple hundred thousand people, and I had never heard of things like dowsing for water before.
Really?
Why would I have heard of that? First of all, it's nonsense. Second of all, hey. I didn't grow up in a farm where we had wells.
In this book, I'll have you know, Uncle Al says there are some scientists who think dowsing is real. So, myth busted.
Oh, yeah, well. Let's get the QAnon people on that.
Oh, God. That's funny. I don't know if I ever explicitly learned about that concept. But also, I don't know why it would have come up in my childhood either.
Well, that's what I mean, right?
Like, you had like a sink with a tap on it.
I imagine that well drilling technology has advanced in the 60 plus years since this book was written and published.
Probably.
I don't know anything about drilling wells, but I really hope it doesn't involve dowsing these days.
Yeah.
Another little element of culture that this book introduced me to is the concept of the neighborhood busybody.
Oh, yeah.
And this is a great element for a kid's book. Right? Because a lot of kids' stories capitalize on this idea of, oh, there's one creepy house on the block.
Mm-hmm.
And there's
mm-hmm.
mysteries in that house.
That's usually the book that I would have picked up.
Yeah, that would have been right up your alley. And there's something strange, something unusual going on in the neighborhood. And it's because of the creepy house
right.
or the creepy people that live in that house. And in this case, because this book is decidedly not supernatural, the mystery of the creepy neighbor ends up being mundane to the point of farce.
Yeah,
it's hilarious how anticlimactic the reveal is.
Right. I liked Midge's theory, which is that Mr. Apple is burying bodies in his back lawn. But that suggestion is pretty much just always played for laughs. Like, at no point is there any actual tension around this idea. Like, Henry just completely dismisses it out of hand. And so he's, like, almost disinterested in the mystery and kind of, like, reluctantly gets interested in it. And then the reveal at the end is very, like, oh, okay. Well, that's, don't know what I expected.
Yeah, yeah. it's funny.
It is. It's very good.
It's funny because it's the opposite of mysterious
yeah.
when it comes down to it.
And it fits with the like overall setting of the book, too, and the constant jokes about, you know, how many PhDs does it take to clear a tractor out of a road?
Yep.
What ends up happening is Mr. Apple has this patch of lawn that he's very protective of and won't let anything near and starts erecting, like, fences and stuff around it. And, of course, what ends up happening is the kids herd some errant sheep into the fenced-in area because it's fenced. It's safe to keep the sheep there, and they don't know why this guy is like so weird about this area. But it turns out he thinks he's onto something. He's developing a new kind of grass.
Mr. Apple is.
Yeah. So this is like the actual research project of the book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the only real research in the book.
But it's very funny. It's one of those things that, like, as a kid, I'm sure I would have read it and been like, what? Not really thought about it. But as a kid, fits in with those larger themes and things happening in the background.
Yeah. And, you know, now, as a grown adult, I have encountered my fair share of busybodies and people who love rules because they love to have rules enforced. That's the reason that they love rules. These are the people that go on to participate in homeowners association boards and stuff like that.
I like that in your notes, actually, referring to Mr. Apple as the local HOA enforcer.
That's basically what he is before HOAs were a thing.
Yeah. Yeah. He's you know that you're severely unpleasant when even kids who have no reason to interact with you know that you're severely unpleasant.
So this book also had a rabbit in it.
It was a very important rabbit, and that rabbit was absolutely psychic. That rabbit knew what was up. That rabbit is a true child of El Herrera.
Do you remember the rabbit's name?
Jedediah. I don't remember the lady rabbit's name, the one that doesn't run away until the end.
Me neither.
But I did recognize the specific breed of rabbit. What did they say?
Was he a lop?
No.
An Angola?
No, it was a English giant or Flemish giant, I think.
Flemish yeah. feels right.
Yeah. But they're a very specific kind of rabbit. They are very large. Matilda! That's the lady rabbit's name. The doe. They are a specific kind of rabbit. Checkered giants, that's it. Described as, they're great big white rabbits with black spots. That is correct. They're also very soft, and they're impressive at the state fair. I like them.
Jedediah is a great little ancillary character in this book.
He's the best character.
Because Henry and Midge spend the entire book trying to catch him.
This is because Henry is incredibly sexist. Just kidding. He tells Midge that she can have her name on the sign and she can be a partner in the business if she is able to bring something to the business, which is, you know, not unreasonable, I suppose. And she says, well, I got two rabbits. And he's like, cool, great, two rabbits will do it. And she's like, well, I really only have the one rabbit in a hutch, though. The other one, like, you know, he escaped and I've been trying to catch him all summer. So Henry says that once they catch Jedediah, she can have her name on the sign. And attempts to catch Jedediah are more than anything what propels the plot or the short stories, the sketches forward.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right.
Yeah. Which is cute. It's just, the whole thing is very cute.
There are several good animal friends, in fact, in this book. Jedediah and Matilda, the rabbits. There's Agony, the beagle.
Agony.
What was the name of the cat?
Oh, geez. I don't remember. I'll find it later. But the cat is good. And of course, just from describing, there's two rabbits, a cat and a dog. You know what happens in the book. Like, there's multiple chase scenes of multiple animals all tearing around after each other and tripping people and causing chaos. It's really quite good. My favorite thing about it, though, is that nobody ever gets hurt. None of the animals manage to catch each other. The climactic scene at the end where Henry accidentally sends his beagle Agony up in a balloon. The beagle's fine. A little shaken, but okay.
Yeah.
He had an adventure.
I actually remember reading that part of the book as a kid and feeling very tense.
I'm sure.
I was like, oh my god, the beagle is gonna fly away to the atmosphere. Eventually that balloon's gonna pop and the beagle's gonna die. I was very scared of that, but fortunately that doesn't happen.
Yeah.
Here's another concept the book introduced me to. I had never in my life heard of truffles until I read this book.
That's a good part. I liked that part.
I don't think, well, I didn't lead the kind of life as an 8 or 9 year old where I would have ever encountered truffles. My family, you know, had mushrooms in meals, in foods, but I had never heard of special mushrooms like truffles before.
I don't know if my parents even know what they are. I don't know if my parents have ever had truffles. Which kind of tells you some things about, like, Henry and his life, right? He's used to truffles. He knows what they are. He knows what a truffle dog is because he lives in Italy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I could probably count on one hand the times in my life I've actually eaten truffles also.
We had them at that one restaurant that one time.
We've had them at a couple of restaurants, but it's like, here's a shaving of truffles, and it costs $5. It's like, ooh, fancy. But yeah, that's it's not a part of my regular existence, and it certainly wasn't when I first read this book as a kid.
Right. What about the part where he stumbles across the old pottery?
See, that was one of the coolest parts of the book for me as a kid.
I thought it would be, yeah.
Because he basically does some unintentional, legitimate archaeology.
He does!
Which is super cool. And obviously this is the sort of thing that is really only possible on the East Coast, but he encounters or he uncovers fragments of pottery from the first potter to ever reside in the area of Princeton, New Jersey, like 250 years ago or something like that. And actually get some like museum quality pieces out of just like, oh, I'm just gonna like dig up the soil here with a shovel and my dog.
Whole pot. It's not even like a shirt either.
It's like a whole pot.
Yeah, and he's very dismissive about it. It's very funny. Thinks it's pretty ugly.
Yeah.
Not a very good pot.
This is interesting. I guess I remember thinking that Henry had it all wrong here. When I got to this part of the book, I was like, don't you realize what you've got? You've got like a legitimate historical artifact here. And you just think it's like an ugly pot. Yes, it is that. But it is also a legitimate historical artifact. Don't you get this? This is the coolest thing that you've done in this book. But no. Henry doesn't really care about that.
No. As a kid, did you really want the Indiana Jones movies to be just like lectures of Dr. Jones talking about archaeology?
I always felt that they could use a little more explanation of some of those artifacts.
Like anything at all? Like, even a little bit?
I mean, some things you don't want explained. Like, why did they make that ship out of oily rags? But other things like, well, what is the Cross of Coronado and why is it important? Maybe there is a comment about that in the movies. I don't really remember that, the dialogue that well.
Well, it doesn't surprise me that you picked up on the archaeology in this book. That was one of the things I read and I was like, yeah, Jay loved this part. The other part was definitely the dog and the balloon. How did you feel about the part that I thought that was the least engaging, which was the car swap at the 4th of July?
I didn't remember that at all. Yeah. That's how...
It's kind of boring.
Yeah, that was the part that I just didn't even recall happening when I reread this book. And I must have read this book 3 or 4 times as a kid. Probably all within the same 2-year span or something. But I had no recollection of that event because it is... probably the least memorable event in the book.
I think it's got something interesting happening where Henry sort of opens this chapter talking about how he was very excited to have a proper 4th of July. And he's apparently never had one before. He's never been in the U.S. on the 4th of July, as far as he remembers. But what he does know is his parents' stories about what the 4th of July is. And he has a expectation of the 4th of July that I've never had, which is that you get to run around setting off fireworks yourself. And it's just a smorgasbord of blowing random stuff up, all kinds of bottle rockets and whatever. And he's really mad because when he finally gets to do this, he doesn't get to set anything off. He has to go to a park and watch some idiots set off fireworks like a long way away from him. And for me, growing up, like when I was a kid, you would have like sparklers and you would get like maybe a couple fireworks that one of your uncles would bring and your mom would yell at him. But the expectation was definitely to see the fireworks was like going to see the fireworks. It's a passive thing where you all get in the car and you go somewhere together.
Yeah, this is one of those generational things. Because I also didn't have any expectations as a kid that I would ever set off fireworks. We didn't even do the sparklers because my mom was petrified of those.
Oh, really?
But we also had, like, I have an uncle who only has 3.5 fingers on one hand because of a fireworks mishap as a kid.
All right.
Which is exactly the accident referenced in the book that Henry is so disgusted at because that's what keeps kids like him from having the fun of setting off fireworks and blowing off their hands.
Yeah. I was like, okay, this is one of those things that really does date this because I know that my parents had that expectation. I don't know what kids these days think the 4th of July is. I would assume it's probably similar to what we did.
Yeah.
You go somewhere, you look at fireworks, you're kind of bored.
Yeah. You know, I never made the connection until right now, but the image of the fireworks reminds me very much of the movie The Sandlot, which kind of takes place in a similar time period. Yep. The Sandlot's a little bit later, but not much.
I think it's participating very much in the same cultural project, though.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I hate The Sandlot.
I know you do.
Can't stand it.
I like it because there's a very good dog.
I should like it. It's got different things in it that I like. There's a dog. There's a creepy neighbor. There's a mystery. Mm-hmm. Right? I don't know why I hate it so much.
There's really not much there for girls.
I think there's that. I think it's also probably...
It's a pretty misogynistic movie in a lot of ways.
I think I clocked that early. But I think also it was maybe the context that I watched it in. It was one of like 3 movies they would put on when... I would go with my mom to her choir practice, and they'd put on movies to keep the kids entertained.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Wow.
Just let me bring a book.
What was your favorite money-making scheme from this book?
That's a good question. They had some good ones. Mine, I think, was almost certainly, and you're not going to be surprised by this at all, selling the painted turtles.
That was mine, too.
It's genius. It's so smart. That's just like the most capitalist innovation I've ever heard of in my life.
You take a turtle, you paint a flower on it, and then you sell it for 65 cents at your friend's mother's garden tea party.
Perfect. Flawless.
There you go.
Absolutely. You're going to go to a friend's garden tea party? You're going to buy a painted turtle.
There's a
You're
turtle.
You're going to buy several painted turtles.
There's a turtle wandering around the lawn with a cute flower drawn on it.
Oh, yeah. I'm going to pick that up.
There you go.
No question.
Yep.
When I was a kid, we would go up to visit my grandparents, and there wasn't... I really loved going to visit these grandparents. Even though there wasn't, like, a ton to do, there was also a lot to do. My grandma... I don't remember us having, like, any real TV or anything. But she did have a house just absolutely full of different craft things, and she liked to make stuff with us. So you could, like, make up a project that you wanted to do, and you could probably find something in my grandma's hoard to do that project. So I remember one summer we got really into... I think we saw this in a book, like some sort of 1950s craft book that she had of, like, fun things for kids to make. There was a little craft where you get some glue and you find some rocks and you glue the rocks together in the shape of a turtle, and you can paint the turtle to look like a turtle or to look like other things. So we made a lot of little rock turtles and we painted them, and I think a couple of them had flowers on their shells. So what I'm saying is I'm an entrepreneur, and an angel investor should shoot me some cash for cool painted turtles.
That's very wholesome until you got to that last part.
I think my grandma still had some of those in her house when she died, too. I couldn't have been older than 10 doing that.
I wouldn't be surprised at that at all.
Yeah.
I would believe that immediately.
I really like this kind of book. Even though we mentioned that, you know, I would have struggled with it because it didn't have a strong plot, it's a genre of book that I read a lot of, which is kid has adventures that are increasingly zany during the summer vacation.
Except that the ones that you read, you've said, tended to have stronger narratives.
They had some sort of, like, larger story, although a lot of the time the zany antics would be somewhat independent of each other.
Hmm.
Like the McDonald Hall books, usually the different antics that they would get into would be somewhat connected in that there would be increasing disciplinary measures, I think. But, like, they could also be kind of shuffled in whatever order.
Yeah.
I really like reading this age of book again, this, like, age range. And there's a couple reasons why I like it. One of them is that I know it's much harder to write these books than you would ever imagine from reading them. And your craft as a writer to write one that's even halfway engaging has to be really on point, because you don't have any real fat to trim. Like, this is going to be, what, how many pages are in this sucker?
215 or something? 239.
Yeah. You got a tight 239 pages, and that's a long book for one of these. You're usually looking at, like, 200 or something. And you got to get your characters from point A to point B, and it's got to be memorable, and they've got to all be established very fast and very strong. And I feel like this book nails that. And I kind of wish that a lot of the adult books that I read were halfway as good at being compelling fast and establishing realistic people fast and sticking in your head fast. And that's not to say every one of these books is amazing, but I really like reading stuff in this age range. I think that's part of the reason why I respond emotionally so strongly to this basic setup of adventures over summer vacation. I read so many things like this. I wished that I had cool adventures like this. And the reading experiences, for the most part, were always at the same time a little disposable because there's a billion books like this. They also just, like, they can really stick with you, and they're just fun. You have a good time.
Yeah. It's kind of funny. When I read this book for the first time, I was just entering that age where I started to develop preferences in the books that I was choosing to
mm-hmm.
read.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, you get to second grade, you get to third grade, you get to fourth grade, and your school has a library and you can choose books from the library. And often you have to, you know, do a certain amount of reading every week or whatever for your class. But you get to make your choices. And you get to choose, like, oh, do I want to read, you know, this fantasy novel or this book about a kid having adventures over the summer, or this book where the main characters are rabbits, or whatever. And you get to choose these things and start to fill out your literary preferences.
Mm-hmm.
So this was really one of the first steps of that for me. And I read a lot of books as a kid, but a lot of the things that I read when I was younger than this were just whatever I had access to. Mm-hmm. You know, everything that I might have had access to. All the kids' books in my house. You know, I would go to the library and just read anything, basically, that was in my age range. But as you got older, or as I got older, I started to be a little more selective and exercise literary choice. And this was one of the first books that I ever reread, I think.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because I read it and I was like, oh, this is really cool. And I read it again, you know, later in the year or something like that, because I bought a copy at one point.
Wow.
We had a copy of the book that I remember having when I was, you know, 10 years old or something.
I think I remember some similar things. One of the like chapter books that I remember most clearly as something that I picked and that I started kind of forming an identity around, this is the kind of thing that I like to read, was when I was in third grade, I read Mr. Popper's Penguins. And I will never forget that. I have very strong associations with that. But it's a pretty similar book, similar age range, similar length. The big difference is obviously that the protagonist is an adult, but it's also pretty zany. And I don't, for the life of me, remember how I got a hold of the dang book. I'm pretty sure we weren't assigned it in class, but I think it was what you were just talking about, one of those experiences of going into the library and realizing that I could just, like, grab anything I wanted, and I could read whatever. And I wasn't constrained to what I was told to read in class or the books that were already in my house. And I know from that age on, at minimum, maybe earlier, I just don't have any memories of it. One of the big things we would do during the summer is my mom would get us to bike with her to the library. And usually me and my brother, my brother was so young that he would be in a little carrier on the back of the bike. And usually I wouldn't be able to bike the whole way. So she would bring a spare bike lock so that when I got tired, she could just lock up my bike somewhere on the route. And then we could continue. I could sit in the carrier with my brother. We could go to the library. I would pick out a stack of library books taller than me from the little rotating shelves in the front of the library that had all of these chapter books in them. I'd just pick out a big stack of them. And then we would ride back, little carrier, with my huge stack of books in a bag. They're good memories.
Well, we did a lot of bike rides to the library also. We did a lot of reading at the library too, which in retrospect was a genius move, because what do kids know about the library? You have to be quiet. If we were at home, we would have been making a lot more noise. But instead, we were at the library and we would pick books and sit in the kids' reading area and read books quietly.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
You guys were quiet?
Yeah.
Like your mom, too?
I don't remember. Maybe. Yeah. She was quiet, relatively speaking. But we did a lot of reading at the library. Very, very strong, fond memories of that as a kid.
Yeah.
All right, anything else to say about Henry reading?
Yeah, I don't think so. I think that wraps it up for me. It was a fun book. It was an ideologically troubled book, but that the ideology, kind of like when we were talking about the sexism in Watership Down, even though it's really core to how the book is, like, structured and what the book is, it's also kind of easy to ignore. So for the capitalist ideology in this, I felt like it was pretty easy to just kind of, like, you know, look past it. I thought that the gender stuff was what it was, but a, you know, pretty decent example of what it was. And mostly I just enjoyed being sort of carried back to that experience of being at the library and picking out a stack of books taller than my head and knowing I could get through all of them. And wondering if this ever would have made it in my pile.
Yeah. Yeah, I really appreciated the chance to go back and reread this book with an adult eye. And I picked up on a lot of little things I didn't pick up on as a kid. Some of it was humor. Some of it was the, you know, these more troubling aspects of the frame story. But it gave me a new appreciation of it.
Well, thanks for picking it out to read. I had a really good time.
Good. Why don't you tell us what we're going to read next?
We're going to read something in a similar-ish age range, read at a similar time in my life. Bruce Cavill's My Teacher is an Alien.
All right, and that was Henry Reed, Inc. And until next time, remember to close read.